Well, thank you very much for... Yes, I have it. So the talk is going to be Blackboard, but partly Blackboard at one point I have to...
So this is the lights.
Yeah.
You
want to remove the screen? Yeah. But I will switch what? Okay. So at one point I will have to go back to the projector because... Otherwise, I'll never be able to write everything I have to write. So it's a first. I would like to thank the organizer because that's my third week here, and I really enjoyed it and learned a lot during this conference. And those talks were really very instructive for me. So my collaborators are on this project, which is actually an old result of us of 2003. Are Shinsei Ryu, who is here, and Akira Furutaki, who is also here. So the team has been reunited for this conference. I'm dealing with problem of Anderson localization, so what I mean by that is the following problem. I start with the Schrödinger equation. And what I'm given is a unperturbed system, H0, which is a Hermitian Hamiltonian, which has translation invariance, and for which the eigenstates are plane waves. They are propagating, they are extended, they are able to support the current. And then I have a perturbation V, which is some random potential that breaks this translation invariance. It is static, it doesn't depend on time, but it's going to break the translation invariance of the clean system. And actually what I'm given is an ensemble of random potentials. Now, let's assume that we were able, for a given realization of this random potential, to diagonalize the system exactly. We will obtain all the energy eigenvalues that depends on the random potential V. And we will also obtain the eigenfunctions with those energies that also depend on the random potential. Now you can, out of this information, you can construct the density of state. And this density of state depends on the realization of the disorder, depends on energy, and it is given by some limiting procedure by which you take a smearing term eta and the volume of the system to zero in this fashion. So the inverse of the volume of the system goes to zero. And then you have this normalization. Okay, so this is a Lorentzian, and that's sum over all the energy eigenvalues of my problem in a given realization of disorder. And that's the global density of state. So here I'm a little loose in the way I take my limit of eta going to zero and the Germanic limit of eta going to infinity. I don't specify exactly how I take it. It's important for the later discussion. So now this is, you can think of it as a random function of energy. It's random because the disorder potential is random. So the energy eigenvalues here are random. And of course, what you can try also to calculate is the product at different energies of the density of state. So here the product runs over the index iota. And you might want to calculate the distribution function of this function that depends on different energies iota here. Now, what you could also want to calculate in this problem is the local density of state, which is obtained as follows. So here, I remove the factor of one over volume, and I put it back here in the sense that I have my eigenfunction at energy. And I think I have to have here, so that would be the eigenfunction at energy E. And then here I have dV epsilon minus epsilon. Okay. And again, you can look at the product of this local density of state at different energies and at different positions in space. And what you could also compute once you are given all those single particle properties of the system for every given realization of the disorder, what you could also compute are correlation functions for the currents, for example, that will give you direct access to the conductivity. So by looking at the distribution of those quantities here, this one here, their products, the distribution of the correlation functions built out of currents, you can decide if the effect of the disorder is going to localize the wave function of the clean system that began, with which we began, that was a plane wave, an extended wave function. Now, so of course the questions we're interested is about the possibility that the disorder is going to localize the wave function, and this is a question that we want to address in this very indeterminate limit when L goes to infinity. So what we want to address is, are there localized states? If there are localized states, is there a transition as a function of some parameters that will turn the system from a metal to an insulator? And if there is such a transition, what is the nature of the critical behavior at this transition, if it is a continuous transition? And the answer to this question is going to depend crucially on how you take the thermic limit. So that's element one. The symmetries that are respected by the statistical ensemble that you're using when you're doing the disorder averaging. The spatial, so when I say the statistic, so that's the symmetries properties of this statistical ensemble. But it will also depend on the spatial correlations of the probability distribution for the disorder potential. And finally, it will depend on the dimensionality D, the dimensionality in which we are working. So what you can do, for example, is to define the mesoscopic regime . And in this mesoscopic regime, what you do is that you take the limit of the infinite size system, but you scale down the strength of the potential of the disorder in such a way that you can always do perturbation theory to treat the effect of disorder. And that defines the mesoscopic regime. On the other hand, what you can do is that you can take the infinite volume limit, but you keep the disorder strength constant. And that will be the case of interest to me today. So then I'm going to make one.
Excuse me, what do you mean that you can do perturbation theory in the disorder?
So
if you mean that the different terms exist formally in the expansion, or that the you can prove that the expansion is asymptotic?
So what I think what people do usually, but I don't know if what people do is that they scale the disorder strength in such a way that, or if you want, they have a small parameter in the theory that remains small always. And for example, you can do it in a controlled fashion in the following way in quasi 1D. Which I was going to allude to in a few minutes, but there it's like a large N expansion, essentially large N expansion. So you can view it like that. You have a conductance, the bare conductance of the problem is you start with a little disordered metal. The metal initially is disordered a little bit, so you have the bare value of the conductance G0, which is a large number, and you do an expansion in 1 over G0. Now, of course, if you keep the disorder strength fixed as you take the thermic limit, this is not this bare coupling is going to run and might get smaller and smaller, so this expansion parameter is not going to be a good expansion parameter. But you can cheat in the sense that you change the bare value of the coupling constant in such a way that this expansion parameter always remains small as you take your thermic limit. And this defines the mesoscopic regime. This essentially defines random matrix theory, the random matrix theory regime that describes diffusive metals. So that's one. So it's just about scaling limits. You know, you take the thermic limit, but you have other parameters at hand, and you can do things with the other parameters so that you define different regimes in this fashion. So, but here, I'm not going to talk about mesoscopic regime. I'm going to look at the situation when the disorder strength is held fixed while you take the thermodynamic limit. But what I'm going to impose on my distribution for the random potential V is that there exists an operator which is unitary, and this operator gamma is going to anti-commute with my potential for every realization of the disorder. And this has a name. Well, these are different names. Essentially, people coming from high energy physics will identify such an operator as being a Dirac operators with massless quarks, and they will call this symmetry a chiral symmetry. And this terminology has become standard even in Anderson localization. So whenever you have a situation by which your statistical ensemble of Hamiltonian anti-commutes with a unitary operator, you talk about chiral disorder. And this will be the situation that I'm going to consider to be in today's talk. So the simplest example of a realization in condensed matter of a system, of a random system of that type, was actually in disguise. He was not using this language, but was, if you translate a little bit, was studied by Dyson in 1953 already. And what he did was to study the problem of an electron. Again, he was actually looking at phonons, but you can translate what he did, and it's really equivalent to this problem from the point of view of electrons. So what I'm looking at is a chain, and I label the position on the chain, and I have a simple rule. My electron hops on nearest neighbor sites I and I plus 1 of the chain, and the hopping is made of two parts. The hopping amplitude, there is a uniform part T that doesn't depend on the starting point of the hopping process, and then there is a part here that fluctuates, which is random, that depends on the starting point of the electron. Okay, and I wrote it in this fashion, e to the exponential of delta ti, where delta ti you're going to assume to be uncorrelated in space, so it's white noise. For simplicity, we can take it to be Gaussian distributed, but it's not obligatory. And this is the definition of the random hopping problem studied by Dyson. And what Dyson showed was that this problem, of course, has this property because if you change the sign of the electron operator whenever it is residing on an outside of the chain, then what happens is that you change only one of the sign of those two operators here. So you change the overall sign of H by minus, which is equivalent to saying that our gamma here is this operator on the lattice. And hence, it follows that the energy spectrum for every given realization of the disorder has a very nice property, which is that energy eigenvalues come in pairs. Here is the band center. And all the energy eigenvalues are going to be paired in positive and, they're going to be paired in positive and negative sisters. And so this is the property that we have here. This is the implementation of this rule here that defines the chiral class. There is another property that there's another symmetry property here, is that my hopping is always real valued. So it means that I also preserve time Russell symmetry in the problem. I didn't put spin, so of course I also preserve spin rotation symmetry. So I really have a very, very symmetric problem, a highly symmetric random problem by which I have time Russell symmetry, spin rotation symmetry, and also sublattice symmetry. And what he showed is this remarkable result that the global density of state, so this object here, is divergent when you approach the band center.
This is the average of the disorder realizations.
Well, it doesn't really matter here.
Why?
I'll tell you why. So tau is essentially, this is a length scale, it's the mean free scattering time. I guess mean scattering time. And it essentially is related to the width of the distribution of the delta TIs here. And this is a remarkable result because naively you would have expected that there is enhanced, well, so of course this result applies for very small energies. How small? Well, as long as they
Oh,
I just, I just look. Okay, so.
This is one dimension.
Yeah. So it's a single chain, and.
So just
hoping that they should talk
to it, that's it, right?
Yeah, a real hoping.
You remain real.
Real.
Why is so?
Because there is, if you change the sign of the wave function on every even odd side, the Hamiltonian change by a sign. So this operation is implementing there exists a unitary operator that anti-commutes with this Hamiltonian for every given realizational disorder, and this property I call Carroll.
I suppose it's, it does not.
Yeah, it will be Carroll too by this definition. No, it's just terminology. Okay, site. If you linearize the spectrum, yeah. It's just terminology. It's abusive language. Don't worry about it. It's not important. No, not yet. No. It doesn't mean that. It just, I guess it comes from Carroll symmetry breaking in QCD and how the quarks acquire mass. And it doesn't matter. I could call it sublattice symmetry. I didn't choose this terminology. You go and blame Schambauer, or you go and blame those people. So it's just a name.
Equivalent.
Equivalent. Okay.
Hamiltonian has a block structure. That's what Carroll means in this case. It commutes with some.
Okay.
That's all it means.
Okay.
Why do they call it Carroll?
Okay, sub lattice. We have to. People have introduced this terminology.
When we say this terminology, by Carroll means a selection of states of this Hamiltonian, which eliminated by projector 1 plus gamma phi. This is called Carroll sector.
Okay, Paul, just think sublattice symmetry all the time. I say Carroll by mistake. So, the point is that here's the result that Dyson derived, and this is a very surprising result. Why? Because you see that you have when you approach the band center, you are guaranteed to have enhanced level repulsion, because the lowest energy eigenvalue in the spectrum from above the band center has a mirror image. As you make the system bigger and bigger, eigenvalues are getting are going to get closer to each other. They are going to approach the band center, and automatically this guy is going to sense the presence of this guy there. And you will expect that if you put this order, there will be enhanced level repulsion. So naively, what you will think is that what should happen with this symmetry present is that the effect of this order is to deplete the density of state close to the band center. Now, you take the thermic limit, and then what you find is this divergence, this 1 over energy divergence corrected by this with this log correction. So this is quite surprising. What is wrong with the argument is So what it means is that there exists a diverging length scale in the problem, a length scale which I'm going to call maybe abusively the localization length, but in this problem it is not quite the localization length. So there is exists a length scale, at least one. Actually, there are maybe more than one. But there exists a length scale that diverged as you approach the band center. Well, the argument is precisely, if it was not like that, if it was not true that all length scale remain finite, it will mean, and in particular, if the wave functions were exponentially localized by the disorder, you could break your chain into boxes of size xi, where xi is this assumed finite localization length. And then, essentially, the system will break in independent boxes of finite size xi. And now you could use the argument, which is essentially random matrix theory. So you could go and look at what happens to the spectrum in a finite box, which might be big, but it is finite. You will then look at the smallest energy eigenvalues, or the closest energy eigenvalues to the band center. They come in pairs. And you could just reduce the problem to a two-level problem. And then you could ask, I put this order, but the disorder that I have to put has to preserve both this symmetry and time resource symmetry. And it turns out that you're not allowed to put any more. The only thing you could you're not allowed to put disorder in the diagonals. You're not allowed to put the disorder proportional to the second Pauli matrix because it has an imaginary part and it will break time resource symmetry. So essentially, nothing is going to happen for this two-level system, and that's a prediction of random matrix theory. That is a caricature of random matrix theory that will tell you that the density of state actually will be predicted in this symmetry class to go to a constant value at the band center. But of course, we find a diverging density of state, so something must be wrong in this argument, and what goes wrong is, of course, that there exists a diverging length scale, that there is, in that sense, there is a critical behavior at the band center. And, yes?
The thermodynamic limit here is taken by keeping constant the distribution of the disorder. You don't scale the distribution.
Okay, so I will, yeah. So the disorder strength is going to be held constant. And the other thing that I'm going to keep constant is I will do the following. I will keep eta finite, then and then take L going to infinity, which means that when I compute the density of state in this box, I am smearing everything. So it's a box of size eta. And I will really have a continuum of state, and a large numbers of state. And hence, I will expect that the density of state will be computed out of this very large sample of eigenvalues, and I would expect that there's that self-averaging emerge out of this averaging process, and that's why I didn't say that this was the average. I just say it was the global density of state. In other words, I'm assuming implicitly that this quantity here, defined by keeping eta finite, taking the thermodynamic limit, and then putting eta going to zero, is self-averaging, and I don't need to distinguish. I don't have to average. And
you have to assume that you cannot prove
any of that. You can prove that since self-averaging for complex states is two other very general conditions. We keep the parity of all things, like everything to make one L is even on it.
No, it will not change. Well, you will, of course, if you do finite size, well, if you do it,
you will see something.
And if you take odd numbers of chains, you will see zero modes, and there will be enhanced level repulsion on a very small scale of energy eigenvalues. What you will see if you do numerical calculation is the following. You will see, so the density of state close to the band center in a clean system is it's a number. And then what you will see when you do a calculation is something like that. it goes like that. There is oscillations, and then if you increase the system size, it goes like that. And well, okay, there are always oscillations, but now, and then it goes down. Oscillations, and it goes down. And it is the envelope of the density of state that is behaving in this fashion. And the level repulsion will be stronger if you have an odd number of sites as opposed to an even odd number of sites, because you have zero mode whenever you have an odd number of sites. Okay. So this is... So now, what? Of course, now you could ask, what can you do in more than one dimension in this problem? And the first thing you will attack is not the two-dimensional problem, but it's the quasi-1D problem. And actually, this we did with Pete Brouwer and Akira here and Alex Altland. And what we found was we could rederive this result in a so-called thick quantum wire limit. And this is again playing with the orders of limits in a crucial fashion. So what we do is that we consider a problem when we have n channels. And so you have n coming channels. Well, you have n channels. You have the disordered regions here of size L, of linear size L. And what you do is that there is a mean free path in the problem, which is a characteristic of the variance of the disorder here. And then you keep... So there is a mean free path, if you want, that you define along the wire. And this one you keep fixed as you take the thermodynamic limit. But also what you have is that there is a mean free path, if you want, L transverse. And this one you scale in such a fashion that the mean free path in the transverse direction is always smaller than N times A, where A is the lattice spacing. So essentially, if you do that, if you keep the mean free path in the transverse direction, you keep it always bigger than the transverse size, of the wire, what you can do is that you can do announce that, well, you can describe the system, you can describe the statistical distribution in a way that all the scattering event between different channels is going to be described by some random metrics. And then you are going to only look at the effect of the disorder in this direction, in some sense. And then what you'll find is that you recover this result of Dyson whenever n is odd. And when n is even, you find something different. You find a number times a log of epsilon in this case. So there is a parity effect. And this is captured by really what I will call the true functional RG equation. What you can do is that you can write down a differential equation obeyed by the joint probability distribution of the Lyapunov exponent of a transfer matrix that takes plane wave from coming from the left into plane waves going into the right. This transfer matrix has eigenvalues called Lyapunov exponents. They are random quantities, and you can write down an evolution equation as a function of the systems time for those Lyapunov exponents, and you can show that they obey a diffusion equation on a symmetric space. The symmetric space is uniquely specified by the symmetries of the problem at hand, and then you find that essentially you find this evolution equation for the whole joint probability distributions for the n transverse matrix eigenvalues of this problem. And by studying this equation, which is a diffusion equation, but in a curves Riemannian manifold, you can extract the density of state, the conductance, and all of that. So this is really truly functional RG. It works beautifully well in quasi 1D.
How do these channels interact?
Yes, exactly.
Is it permutation symmetry, or is it all?
It's controlled by the roots of the symmetric space on which you do Brownian motions, and it's very similar to the Calogaro Sutherland equations.
Can I put the next one, or is it a permutation symmetry in these channels?
It depends on the symmetry class.
But that actually the result should depend on that one. It's like a symmetry.
Yes. So
you're saying even ones and odd ones are different. I can imagine that. But if you say make permutation symmetry, then the symmetry.
Sorry, what's the question exactly?
If these electrons can jump from between any channel.
Yes. which is the assumption that we make.
There's no preference of...
No. It's uniformly distributed in the transverse direction. So the randomness in the transverse channel is it's a matrix which is n by n, and it is all independently identically distributed Gaussian, up to the symmetries like time-resource symmetry and spring rotation symmetry. That's the input. The output is that you have this diffusive equation on the symmetric space. Okay?
So you don't
have the
Snapple Hopkins
between them? No, in transverse direction, so you don't do that. Well, the randomness, of course. Not the clean part, doesn't matter.
Excuse me, is there randomness in the transverse direction?
Yes, but this was a digression. This was just to say that you can, this is not the talk, subject of my talk. So I'm just saying, in quasi-1D, you can set up a functional RG method, which is really a truly functional RG in the sense that you follow the evolution of a function. Okay? But you cannot do that. Well, we don't know how to do that in two dimension, and two dimension is the subject of this talk.
Can you have finite stripes? Can you say something?
Yes.
If you have finite
yes.
number.
Yes. Stripes, yes. The method we use is valid for any n. But it is interesting to take. It's valid for any n, but it's also valid in the limit of n going to infinity with the assumptions that I make. Which and this limit of n going to infinity is interesting because that's where you can connect this analysis to a nonlinear sigma model analysis. Yes, it works. But the subject of this talk is to study this problem here on a square lattice, and not in quasi-1D. And it's going to be, we're going to change a little bit the rules of the game. What we're going to do is that we're going to take a different clean part. We're not going to have uniform hopping on the square lattice, but we're going to put a pi flux phase for historical reasons. The only thing we want to have is that the clean system on the lattice should have, at the band center, discrete numbers of Fermi points as opposed to an arc, a Fermi surface. That's the only input that we want. We are actually going to work with two non-equivalent Fermi points in the Brillouin zone. And of course, then we can linearize the spectrum, or the clean spectrum, and we get two copies of Dirac fermions. And then we're going to put disorder, add in the continuum disorder, in such a way that we are going to preserve time-resource symmetry and the sublattice symmetry. And now, what we're going to get is the following Hamiltonian. And I'll give it a name because the model, this random model was introduced by Hatsugai, Wen, and Komoto, I think in 97. And here I have this block here. So you see I have a 2x2 block structure that simply implements the fact that I have this 2x2 block structure. So here, this 2x2 block structure has to do with the fact that I have two Fermi points in my Brillouin zone, and I do linearization about the Fermi points. And then I have to define what is the upper block here. This is not a Hermitian matrix. It is given by the following object. Sigma mu is a Pauli matrix. Mu is running from 1 to 2 because I am describing a two-dimensional system, so I have two spatial directions. So, and then I work in a real space, so that I have a gradient, I have linearized the spectrum, and then I put disorder, and here comes the disorder. So here, I use again my two Pauli matrix, and I multiply it by I times a mu, and that's important, there's an I here, so, and then I take the unit 2x2 Pauli matrix, and again I have an I, and I multiply by as I, this is the disorder A0, and then the last possibility is to have this guy here. And then this is the adjoint of this operator. And I have to specify the rules. So I have white noise correlated disorder. And then I introduce two variances. This is when mu and u are equal to 1 and 2. So that describes this part here, so hence the subscript. And then I have gm, delta mu nu, delta x minus y. This is when mu nu is equal to 0 or 3. And then it is the correlator, the two-point function is 0 otherwise. So now by construction, you can show that there exists, you have two symmetries here. You have time reversal symmetry for this object, this Hamiltonian. So this is complex conjugation. And what implements this tau here is equal to sigma 1, 0, 0, minus sigma 1. And then what you also have is, actually I call it C. C is really this object here in this representation. And then I have IH Hatsugai Wen Komoto, C is equal to minus. And then C is equal to sigma 0, 0, 0, minus sigma 0. Okay. So this is Carroll orthogonal. BD, well, I mean, BD1 probably, but I prefer, I can remember more easily Carroll orthogonal than BD1, A3 free, and whatever. And now?
The physical motivation of considering this.
The physical motivation is that we want to study the critical properties at the band center. And we are going to be able, in this model, to study the critical properties of a transition that is induced by disorder. And we can have a handle, an analytical handle on that. And the hope is that what we learn about this problem is more general, can help us out solving problems like the plateau transition in the quantum Hall effect, could help us even help us out to guess what happens in three dimension at a mobility edge in a regular metal when you have, let's say, only there is no chiral symmetry, but you only have S-wave scatters, and then you don't break time reversal symmetry, you don't break spin rotation symmetry. So it's really, the goal is to try to appreciate and to have a handle on the critical properties induced by disorder in problems of the Anderson localization type. And this is actually the simplest problem for which you have an analytical handle on it. Whether it is realized in nature is a difficult story, because you work always at the band center, and of course interactions are going to open a gap generally at the band center. So there are a lot of instabilities, and the symmetry is essential in the problem, and in real system it's hard to justify having this sublattice symmetry, but we are studying theoretical physics here, so I think we can make this jump of faith and study this problem on its own right. And now...
If I want to realize microscopic it's a normal
essay. Yes, that works too.
What should we put?
Random hoping.
That's
it.
Real,
real, of course. Otherwise, you don't have time reversal symmetry. That's the ingredient. PyFlux says graphene, random hoping, nearest neighbor. That's it. Well, I mean, not even random hoping that preserves the sublattice symmetry.
What's A3?
Yeah, how do you get all the A's?
Yes.
By symmetry. So this is intra-valley scattering. Okay? So the different wavelength component of the disorder. Well, this you can think of a random gauge field with an eye. So it's a random imaginary gauge field. This is a random scalar potential with an I, so it's imaginary random scalar potential, and this is a random mass. No, H, look, Paul. No. This is Hermitian. This block is not, but here we have the adjoint of this block. So, now here is the statement. Here is the result that I want to sketch how to get to. So the global density of state renormalized properly.
So, sorry, just a question. If you take a hexagonal
lattice, honeycomb, yeah?
Of course it comes to the arc spectrum, it could be uniform.
Yes.
Well, you want to do it not uniform.
Yes.
It could produce a gap, right?
Yeah, but because I'm assuming that those guys have zero mean. So if this guy has a mean value, of course I'm opening a gap. But I'm assuming that there is no, so I don't start with a gap system. Of course, if I had started with a gap system, it would be interesting. If this other strength is larger than the gap, I'm going to fill the gap and, you know, something interesting might happen. But that's not the rules of the games. So.
This Dirac operator, the coefficient in front of the gradient, is of course, does move, right? Does fluctuate.
The velocity. The velocity. Yeah.
If you do it everything random,
no. So I think this one you can gauge. Essentially, you will be able to gauge out. That's forward scattering. So you think you can remove it by? I think.
When you mean a random velocity, a random curve in terms of a gradient term, that is irrelevant by power count being above the norm. So you can put it in, but it goes away long distance.
I think you can gauge it out, but I think you can dispose of it. Okay, so. The result, so now I want to compute the density of states. So the analog of this quantity in 1D, I want to compute in 2D. And here's the result. So the result I want to show is that it is controlled by a dynamical exponent, Z of A. And this dynamical exponent is given by 1 plus GA divided by pi. If GA is smaller than 2 pi, so GA is the variance of the imaginary random vector potential. So this is true, this line is true if G of A is smaller than 2 pi and GM is equal to 0. And if GA is bigger or equal to 2 pi and GM is still equal to 0, then we have this result here. So this is so here what I have done, I will treat the case of non-vanishing GM in 2 seconds. But now I have set the variance of this random scalar potential and random mass to 0. I only have random vector potential, imaginary. And I find that there is an object ZA, a dynamical exponent, which is a function of G of A. So I have a line of critical points at zero energy, and which is parametrized by the variance G of A of the disorder. But what is remarkable is along this line of critical point, which is very similar to what you are all familiar with in nuclear physics, a line of critical point characterized by some G's are there in nuclear physics. Here we have a G of A, but what is remarkable is that the exponent Z of A is an analytic function of G of A along this line of critical point. There is an analyticity when G of A is equal to 2 pi. And this is the onset of the freezing transition. And this is the result that I want to sketch. How do we get this amazing result when you think of it?
What's the run?
Sorry?
The run?
Okay, so what you are doing here is that you are calculating, you have a critical theory at epsilon equal to 0, you perturb with a relevant perturbation, and then you do a one-loop calculation. And at one point, the one-loop calculation is going to break down. So in other words, epsilon is going to grow in this RG scheme, and it's going to be of order 1. And this is the scale, while epsilon renormalized is the scale at which the one-loop calculation is going to break down. So you cannot trust this calculation anymore. So you have, this is a scale where, well, so you assume that this is small. It's the counterpart of the statement here, that you are very close to the band center, and how close you have to be is controlled by this tau here. Here is controlled by this epsilon renormalization. And here I had switched off G of M, and now I'm going to switch back G of M. And when I switch back G of M, the theory at quote-unquote zero energy is not critical anymore. It's a more subtle theory. What happens then is that G of M is actually has a vanishing beta function, and this is a non-perturbative result proved by Guruswamy, Andreas, and Leclerc in 2000. But G of A is going to run, and it's going to run to strong coupling. And as a result of the run of to strong coupling, you are guaranteed that G of A is going to become, it's going to become scale dependent, but it's always going to get larger than 2 pi. So this freezing transition has to take place in some fashion, and it's going to take place in a way that the density of state is going to be proportional to minus C times a log, The log is epsilon renormalized divided by epsilon. And then here, you put the exponent two-third. And what is non-trivial is to get to this exponent two-third. There was a calculation done by Gade in 91, and she predicted the one-half. But we believe that it is incorrect exponent. This universe exponent should be two-third. And the reason why it should be two-third is because you have to capture somehow this freezing transition that appears in the simpler version of the model when you have switch off G of M. So now I would like to try to give you a feeling of how to...
is it possible that your exponent become negative in the first result on GM is zero? So can you get divergent?
Yes. But that's not an issue.
But in Gade-Gregner, you always get suppression of the density of the origin, right?
I forgot something. There is one other energy here. Sorry. I wanted to go fast, and then I make mistakes. Always follow your notes. Okay.
If you take a graphite and make it once random, but slightly random around the GS case, you will get into this matrix but all balls will be free. They will be non-zeros.
If you don't preserve the sublattice symmetry, correct?
Yeah.
Correct. But I'm not trying to describe this problem, Paul. I'm allowed to define my problem and try to solve it, and that's what I'm doing. I motivated the fact that I had Dirac fermions because if you want to have an intuition why I start with this continuum model, I said you could go back to the lattice, put pi flux space, look at graphene, but I'm going to restrict the disorder. You know, there are 10 symmetry classes for disorder, and the Carroll class are the ones that are the most constraining. The most symmetries are imposed on the random Hamiltonian when you work with what I call the Carroll class, the sublattice symmetry classes. Because they are so constraining, they are difficult to realize in nature. But because they are so constraining, they offer hope to be more accessible analytically. And they have proven to be more accessible analytically. If I go back to the Fick quantum wire limit and the DMPK equation, that is the scaling equation that I was talking about, the Carroll class has the simplest of all diffusive diffusion, DMPK equation. In particular, it turns out that, in the Fick quantum wire limit, you can see that the DMPK equations are the simplest of all possible 10 DMPK equations that you can build. And that's the Carroll class. Okay. So now, that was the introduction with the result that I want to sketch. And I attack the problem in two stages. The first stage is to treat the problem when G of M is equal to zero, and then I put back G of M not equal to zero. So when G of M is equal to zero, I call the Hamiltonian MDH. The reason why I call it after Motrinich, Damley, and Hughes is because there exists a lattice model that realizes this problem in a continuum. And they found it. They wrote it down. And the MDH is simply obtained from this one by killing this and that. So now you pull a little magic here. What is the question? A0 and A3.
Yeah, so what makes them equal in the variance? Is it an additional restriction?
This is additional restriction. No, it's not symmetry.
If you make them not equal, then what happens?
I think it will not...
It will always be normalized to the line is the variance for A0 and A3 equal.
Yes.
So the difference is irrelevant.
Hopefully.
Yes, it is. You can just do weak coupling analysis, as Shinzo said.
So to attack the problem, I pull this trick here, and that's called the Hodge decomposition. What I mean by that is that I have a vector potential, a two-dimensional vector potential, and I can always introduce this quantity. and to decompose mu into this part and to this part there. This is, in language of gauge field, that would be a pure gauge part, and that would generate a random, well, a magnetic field, if this was to be thought as a vector potential that gives you a magnetic field. And once I have pulled this magic, so I just changed, this is a reparametrization of this order in terms of two scalar field, phi 1 and phi 2. And now I do the following trick, which is really the magical trick special to the problem at hand, is that I can do this transformation, which is a chiral transformation, and if I put a minus here, I have to put a change the sign here, and I change the sign here. And in this way, I can remove formally. I change my. I do this transformation here, and then the disorder that was here is sitting here and there, and that's very nice. And by the way, once I have done this, I have done one. And I have to remind you that if you carry this transformation on the probability distribution that gives you those moments here, what you find is that phi mu at x, phi mu at 0, disorder average, which I denote with an overline, is equal to minus delta mu nu, g of a 2 pi log x. And that's mu and v is equal to 1 to 2. Okay, so what we really have done right now at the level of single particle physics in the presence of this random potential parametrized by mu or by phi 1 and by phi 2 is to tell you that if ever psi prime 0, which is a 4 vector, right? So this has two components, this has two components. If psi prime 0 is a 0 mod of our matrix, our kinetic energy, the clean kinetic energy, then this object here exponential Pauli matrix, so here I have my spinner prime, this is a zero mode of the random system. Okay, it's a zero mode of this guy here in the presence of disorder. So now let me do a naive scaling analysis. And now you should believe me for 2 seconds that because of this nice property that I wrote here, the system at zero energy. I should not say system at zero energy, but let me just say formally, I would like to say that the inverse of H, Montreux-H, Dahn, Hughes, is in some sense a critical object, in the sense that if I want to represent the resolvent by a path integral, the action that I'm going to use to represent this resolvent is going to be some critical function.
How come HWK became MDH?
No, Ilya.
Oh. I
didn't drop. I attacked the problem in two stages. I stated the problem at two stages. I solved it in two stages. So there is a statement that I make when g of m equal to zero, for which I can put the I can prove the things in the most rigorous way, and then there is a statement when g of m is not equal to zero, which is harder to handle, because the sphere is not critical anymore. But I'll come back on what I mean by this being critical. But what I'm really after, right? I am not after this object, but I'm really after this object here, which I need to calculate the density of state. And this object comes with a unit 4x4 matrix here. And remember that under my sublattice symmetry, this changes sign. But if I put this energy, I have a unit matrix here, and the sublattice symmetry doesn't change the sign of this object. So, So my sublattice symmetry, which is a property of H or its inverse, is not a property of the Green function at finite energy. Okay? So you can view, you can have a, this is telling you that if ever, whatever I'm going to use to calculate this object here, formally, if ever this is critical, if I perturb it, if I do a I enter a perturbation to calculate this object here with energies here, those are chiral symmetry breaking perturbations, and they should be relevant because they are symmetry breaking perturbations. So the idea is now is that what I mean is that now you can imagine that putting this energy is going to induce a length scale in the problem. And hence you want to relate energy and length scale. And then you introduce the dynamical exponent, C of A, that does the job. And now you do scaling analysis. So you know that the density of state has units of 1 over energy, by definition. So it should be like 1 over energy. But it's also density of state per unit. Well, it is an object that has dimensions of 1 over volume. So then you need, and the volume is going to be some length scale that is introduced by this relevant perturbation to the critical behavior. And now if you assume that this length scale is related to energy via scaling on that, and you define the exponent to be Z of A in this fashion, then of course you get this result. And now the question is, what is, if you have this scaling, if this scaling analysis were to hold, what Z of A should you use? And that's a non-trivial question. There is, now you have, we have to be very careful. Because we have introduced, we have assumed criticality at this level, we put a perturbation that breaks criticality that introduces a length scale, you are back to the argument of breaking the system, the plane, into boxes of size, linear size psi. And in all those boxes, level spacing is finite, and you're interested at what happens at the close to the band center, and hence you want to know what happens to the lowest energy or the closest energy to the band center. But of course, for different realization of this order, this closest energy is going to be some random energy. It's going to vary. And as you change, as you run the RG scheme, the size of the box is going to change, and you can think of the result of changing the size of the box as changing the level spacing. So if I sit at an energy here, epsilon, what I'm going to see is that I'm going to see energy eigenvalues passing by, like a train, you know? And there will be the smallest energy eigenvalues that is going to pass, and for different realization of this order, it's going to move at a different pace, depending on the other realization. So now, you can argue that, okay, the smallest energies, the closest energy eigenvalue close to the band is some random variable. And it's moving in and out, depending if you pull the system in or out. It's moving, and you want to understand the rate at which it moves, and that's essentially controlled by Z of A. But of course, should it be the typical rate at which the minimal eigenvalue value is moving, or should it be the average? What should we use? If the distribution of the minimum energy is narrow, that's not important. But if the distribution of this minimal energy was very broad, and typical values become not equal to average values, that becomes really essential. So the first statement is that if we want to compute the global density of state, what we should really worry about is the typical value of Z of A in this scaling analysis. Why? Because the global density of state is self-averaging. So if you pick one realization and the system is big enough and you calculate the density of state, you get something which is very close to the thermodynamic limit of the global density of state. And if you just pick a realization of this order, you are likely to get the typical behavior and not the result of some rare events that will maybe control the fate of an average dynamical exponents. So what you really want is to have access to the typical Z of A, or to check if the typical Z of A is different than average Z of A. So now you need a criterion to decide if we have to distinguish between the critical, the typical, and the average value of this Z of A, this dynamical exponent. So at this stage, what one does is that one passes to a multifractal analysis, because we have the wave function here. We can construct the wave function for any given realization of the zero. We have a zero mode at our disposal for any given realization of this order. And we can do a multifractal analysis to get a feeling if typical and average are going to differ. And the wave function that we have at our disposal has a very simple form, which is essentially a consequence of this transformation here. And it is given by this object here. So I neglect the spinor structure. I just look at the part that is of importance to me. And this is the zero mode at the band center for a given realization of this order phi 2. It's only phi 2 that enters in this zero mode here. And what you do now is a multifractal analysis on this wave function. And the multifractal analysis is going to tell you how this quantity here is going to scale with the system size. And this quantity here has a simple physical interpretation. If the wave function was like a plane wave, or it was a plane wave,
how much time do you need?
Well, it depends on you. So let's say I can wrap up things in 15 minutes.
Well, does it make sense to give you another power next week?
It's up to you. I rather kill it. I rather kill the problem all at once. It depends how many details you want.
If you go rich to fast.
I'm sorry?
If you go rich to fast, I can't follow it anymore.
Yeah, it's too fast. I agree. It's just very fast. Better if you do it slower.
So the problem is we cannot shift Pierre.
Yeah, because he's leaving.
He's leaving. So I guess the option would be
to stop here.
No. You can maybe continue for another 10 minutes or something to come to some close for today.
Yeah.
And have you continue next week, if that's reasonable.
Only the there is a discussion here, but
discussion
session.
Discussion. Yeah, in which format we can discuss. I guess we should. For today, we should come to some close. We shouldn't just
stop. Well, no, but I could stop here because it's that's a natural stopping point.
Okay, so in general, so I know the message. Can you summarize?
Yeah. Well, the answer is there. Right? So he's going. He wants to get the answer.
Tell me what the answer means then for the
scheme. I'm sorry. No. So the red line of the talk is the following. We want to calculate the density of state in a problem where we know that the density of state can be the signature of a critical behavior induced by disorder. And this is implemented by the symmetries that we impose to the disorder. Now, the problem is that to calculate the density of state, we have to introduce the notion of a dynamical exponent, and we have to understand what is the correct interpretation of the dynamical exponent. And I wanted to argue, or I just argued here, that the dynamical exponent that controls the global density of state, which is self-relative averaging, should be the typical dynamical exponent. And my argument was that the dynamical exponent is related to the way eigenvalues in a finite box are moving, right? And that this rate of motions of the eigenvalues as you change the box size is going to change with different realization of disorder. So you could have a distribution of this dynamical exponent, and if ever the distribution of dynamical exponent was broad, then you enter in, well, then you have to verify that it is broad or make sure that it is not broad, and if it is broad, you have to extract the typical value as opposed to the average value of this dynamical exponent. So now we need a criterion to have a handle on this distribution of the dynamical exponents. And the first criterion we can use is the properties of the zero modes, which should not be different from the properties of eigenfunctions that are relatively, which are close to the band center, even if they are localized, as long as the localization length is bigger than the box in which you're working. Now I went back to working in finite sizes. Okay? And then it turns out that the multifractal analysis can be done in this problem by drawing an analogy to polymer physics and to work by Spohn and Derrida. And you can show that this exponent here, tau of q, is going to be an analytic function of g of a. And then you can connect this result with work done by Pierre and Horowitz, and work done by Motronich and Hamlin Hughes, who calculated the density of states and showed that this happens here. So now we have in a different model, but related model. And once we have that, we have a handle on g of a when g of m is equal to zero. Next, we put g of m not equal to zero, and then we use result of Andreas, who showed that g of a is going to run to strong coupling, and we always hit this freezing transition. The reason why I call it a freezing transition, you see it, the easiest way to see it is, well, there was one way, which is in this calculation here. The other way is using the field theory, where you have to reinsert in field theory the notion of functional RG. And then the notion of freezing appears in a natural way when you do functional RG to calculate the density of state. So that's the message of the talk. And
the freezing transition should be defined independent of the length of what is it?
Oh, the point is that this quantity here, this psi, is a measure. I normalize the thing here. And the point is that this power is telling you essentially how the system, this Q is going to select different part of the wave functions. If Q is very negative, you're going to look at very small values of the wave function. If Q is very positive, you're going to look at very large value of the wave function. So this is like a microscope that you use to study what happens to different values of the wave function. And what you're going to see is that when Q becomes large, something is going to happen to this function tau of Q that tells you that the whole weight of this quantity is concentrated in one or two positions in space. And that's freezing in the sense that this object here, if you look at it like that, it's very much like a random partition function. And then the Q can be interpreted as the role, playing the role of temperature. And the Q can be interpreted as playing the role of inverse temperature. Large Q, where somehow something happens in this quantity, corresponds to the low temperature physics of the random energy model, which tells you that the specific heat is zero which corresponds to having a zero specific heat in the analogy to the stat-make problem. And hence the terminology freezing from this point of view, which is, I think, quite intuitive. And the other way is that in the field theory language, what we do is that we start with a conventional RG, but we end up with defining a generating function and showing that the generating function obey the equation that Pierre introduced last week. And these differential equations has traveling wave solutions, and the velocity of those traveling waves are going to freeze if the initial data are cooked up in such a way that depending on the initial data, and the initial data in our problem are controlled by the disorder strength. So when the disorder strength is bigger than 2 pi, you have this selection of velocities of this traveling wave. So that's the other interpretation of this freezing transition.
Not visiting tau, Q will be the point where...
Yeah, so Q always enters multiplied by G of A. So Q and G of A are always together in these calculations. And then non-analyticity of tau of Q is going to be the same non-analyticity as what you have here. And all of that is interpreted as a freezing transition and some kind of breakdown of naive, RG scaling analysis, naive one-loop analysis. And you have to work much harder to, of course, capture something as remarkable as non-analyticity of scaling exponents on something like that, on G of A. Yeah, we computed it, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
No.
As a function of G of A.
Yeah, for A, Q, smaller.
Yeah, yeah.
It's looking
universal depends on the coupling constant.
No, it, on G of A. So what happens is that then the question is how you compute this correctly. So what we can show is that here you have Q. So you can do a naive. So you see the problem is that the weight of this of this randomness is Gaussian. So you will think, oh, it's easy to calculate. But of course, this is not a local observable in the Gaussian theory for phi of 2 because the normalization is there. So you have a trade-off. Either you work with this non-local object and you deal with this normalization correctly, or you exponentiate this object and you get UV field theory. So that's a trade-off. And of course, in UV field theory, you will also have a signature of this freezing transition. Now, if you keep this non-local object and you work with the Gaussian theory, what is easier to do is to take the log of p so that you can dispose of this quantity here. And then the question is calculating the log of the integral over space of this thing here. And then you think of it as a random partition function. And what you find, if you do that, is that now if you assume that this is self-averaging, that's what Andreas did a few years ago, what you'll find is a parabola spectrum. And then here, this is q equal to 1, and that's imposed by normalization, the wave function. Here it's going to be minus 2 because it's the support of the plane. And then there is a problem with this result, because tau of q is a strictly monotonic function of q. So this must be wrong. So now if you compute the log of p of q, and then you do this other averaging, the corrections that the correct interpretation of this result is the following. You take the tangent to this curve, like that, and you take the tangent to this parabola like that. And now the correct answer is you keep the parabola here, then you go straight, and then you go straight here. And here is the freezing transition. I mean, this is the manifestation of the freezing transition. So that's the correct answer. And if you, the typical, and then if you do Lejeune transform of this, you get what people call f of alpha, and then the Lejeune transform of this maps you onto this point here, and the Lejeune transform of that maps you on this point here, and then you get a nice parabola that is terminated, that doesn't go negative, whereas this one will go negative. It would be problematic to interpret.
No,
you have to do it carefully. So nobody knows how to calculate carefully. So so that's the so that will be the interpretation from that point of view. And that tells you that you have some freezing transition going on, and that tells you that you have to be careful in your field theoretical analysis of the problem. And then the question is, how do you find, using conventional techniques of field theory, this, you reproduce this result? So now I'm really over time.
Five minutes break.